It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Growing up in Beckley, Linda Powers was always fascinated by science.
I came home one day from high school. I says, I want to go to college. And, you know, my father's eyes got huge.
No one in her family had ever gone to college. Her story coming up on this West Virginia morning. The state legislature's Joint Committee on Health heard presentations during interim meetings yesterday related to a study on medical marijuana that was authorized during the regular legislative session. Dave Mistich has more.
After three failed attempts to pass a bill that would make marijuana available to those who would benefit from its medicinal properties, Delegate Mike Manypenny of Taylor County continues to press on. With three Republicans co-sponsoring his bill this past session, a public hearing on the issue late in the session, and a successful resolution to study the issue from House Health Committee Chair Don Perdue, members of both legislative houses met to learn more. The committee began with a presentation via Skype from Carmen Hansen of the National Conference of State Legislatures in Denver. Hansen pointed out that 20 states in the District of Columbia currently permit the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes. However, the drug remains outlawed on the federal level and is classified as a Schedule I substance by the Food and Drug Administration, meaning it's seen as having a high potential for abuse with no medical purpose. The floor was then turned over to Marijuana Policy Project legislative analyst Matt Simon, a Parkersburg native who holds a master's degree from WVU, currently living in New Hampshire.
To be clear, what patients are asking for with a state-level medical marijuana law, really two things. They want to be protected from arrest if their doctors have recommended that they use this substance, and they want to have a way to access it safely and legally.
Simon pointed to states like California and Montana, where limited regulations allow for too much access and create as many problems as they solve. He says Maine's laws might provide a better model worth consideration. Simon says 15 states can provide before and after research on medical marijuana legislation, where use by young people has remained the same or even dropped. He also talked about another sticking point that often gums up legislation, the potential state revenue marijuana sales could garner.
Some state medical marijuana programs do bring in significant revenue. Others are revenue neutral. Many are written to be revenue neutral. Fees are set to cover the costs of administering the program, so taxpayers will not bear the burden. And a few states were primarily concerned with patients and not concerned with revenue at all, so they actually operated at a loss, those programs.
The committee finished the hearing by watching a video released in August from CNN and Dr. Sanjay Gupta, titled Weed, that detailed the benefits an epileptic child received from the drug, as well as research being conducted in Israel. Perdue, who also chairs the Joint Committee on Health, called Gupta's report and some of the information provided during the meeting compelling, but says major hurdles remain in dealing with medical marijuana legislation.
How do you get away from the fact that, and I do believe that marijuana is a gateway drug? Well, so are a lot of other medicinals. So again, if you view it only for its medicinal value, that's not a hurdle you should have to overcome. Yet it's going to be back there. It's going to be, that's the thought process. That's kind of the synchronization of the people who oppose marijuana. And I understand that. In the understanding of that, again, the discussion has to be framed in terms of medicinal value, not in terms of recreational use or what might happen or what could happen.
As for Delegate Manypenny, he's working now on building provisions into a new version of this past session's bill.
One of the things that is proposed in my bill is that the taxes generated after the cost of regulating the industry would go to treating substance abuse in the community and drug prevention programs in the school. And then if there's enough money generated, then a percentage of that will go to help build a veterans nursing home in the southern part of the state.
Despite past and planned efforts on the issue, no specific legislation that would allow the medicinal use of the drug in West Virginia was discussed during the hearing. Manypenny says he hopes to firm up potential legislation during legislative interims in December. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
And you can learn more by visiting our website at wvpubcast.org. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:35. Dense fog this morning, cloudy skies today with temperatures in the mid to upper 70s, partly cloudy overnight with lows in the 50s, and partly cloudy on Friday with temperatures in the upper 70s.
Support provided by a West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit WVDRS.org for employer services.
The West Virginia Library Commission is hoping folks across the state will read Kentucky Poet Laureate Frank X. Walker's book called Afrolatcha. As Cecilia Mason reports, the book is this year's choice for the One Book, One West Virginia program.
We stood there, me, him, regret, crowding the edge of the road, same nose, same hands, same nervous smile.
Frank X. Walker reads Clifton One, the first poem in his first book. It tells the story of Walker and his father visiting Clifton, Kentucky, the town where his father grew up.
I search for answers. I wait for clarity and or flames, hidden among the lessons in the stories he pulls from his pockets like peppermint candy covered with lint.
Walker's parents divorced when he was about four. Walker told a small audience gathered at the Martinsburg Berkeley County Public Library that he was a teenager before he started to get to know his father well. Walker is director of the African American and Africana Studies program at the University of Kentucky. He grew up in Danville, one of 11 children raised primarily by their mother in a home in the projects where religion and reading were emphasized. All this is reflected in Afrolatcha.
So in that poem, you can hear my mother's influence, you know, the choir singing psalms, that personal family history with the divorce and still trying to find a way to make it work, that reverence for the land. And this special place that was not just about land was also about water, because he grew up in a place called Clifton, which is at the edge of a cliff. And that water was the dividing line to the next county. Interesting enough, the other county was the official demarcation line for Appalachia.
An old black and white photograph of Walker's parents standing in front of a car with two of his sisters graces the book's front cover. Walker is in the photo, barely. His hand, tinted in red, sticks out from behind one sister. He says it's the only photo he has of his parents together. Susan Hayden with the State Library Commission and West Virginia Center for the Book says everyone in West Virginia is encouraged to read Afrolatcha this year.
We want to just imagine how wonderful it would be if everyone read in the state, read a really wonderful book, and had a fabulous conversation about it.
Hayden says for the past few years, One Book, One West Virginia has collaborated with Shepherd University's Appalachian Writer in Residence program to select a book. While this book is rooted in Walker's Kentucky upbringing, Hayden believes West Virginians can relate to the message it conveys.
I think it speaks of humanness. I think it speaks to our creativity, our joys and love, but hardships, our pain. I think it's universal. It talks not only to a black Appalachian, a black West Virginian, but also all the other races in West Virginia.
Walker says he's flattered his book was chosen.
I think that it says more about what our two states have in common, about what the region has in common, and about this singular idea behind Afrolatcha, that it kind of forces people who have accepted the stereotypes and the caricatures to really rethink what they believe and know about the region.
Walker will continue his residency at Shepherd University through tomorrow evening.
We stood at the edge of the road in Clifton, looking out at the wide, wet mirror that divided one county from the next, absence from forgiveness, then spoke and laughed in unison like twins, like a small choir singing songs.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Martinsburg.
Tonight, West Virginia Public Radio will broadcast the fourth program in our series, Inspiring West Virginians. In a final preview of tonight's program, we meet a woman from Beckley who has distinguished herself on a global stage in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business. Jean Snedeker visited Linda Powers, a bioengineer and builder of groundbreaking scientific instruments.
Jean, I'm going to take you into my biosafety level 2 laboratories in the Bio 5 building at the University of Arizona Medical School. We handle microbes that can make you sick, but generally not kill you.
But you also have a lab where you handle microbes that can kill you.
Yes, that's a BSL-3 laboratory, and that is highly regulated by the CDC. I'm Linda Powers. I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, and I am currently the Thomas R. Brown Distinguished Professor of Bioengineering at the University of Arizona. I am also a professor of electrical and computer engineering and a professor of biomedical engineering. Okay, this is an instrument which I've built. I have a number of patents on these kinds of instruments. This instrument is particularly good for looking for microbes on surfaces.
This small handheld biosensor, one of several clever instruments that 63-year-old Linda Powers has designed, is small enough to take on a backpack out into the wilderness or the desert and can detect microbial contamination in real time.
Surfaces. Let me show it to you.
Cool. Okay.
Now, these are lights. You don't touch the sample ever.
Right.
So this is good.
Yes. It's just on top of a counter or something.
This is light. The light shines on the surface, like my hand here, and the light comes from these LEDs, and this is the detector, so the light captures the fluorescence, and you read it out here on this small computer, or when I was in the Arctic, we used a PDA, just a little handheld thing.
And then you can see what microbes are on that surface.
That's
almost
right.
Instantly?
Yes, instantly. Okay, because it's light. Okay, we're using light. We can't tell what species they are, but I can tell you there's microbes there and the microbial load. And the reason that's important is because these guys are communal, microbes are. And if you have large communities, you will have pathogens living in there. The instruments that I have been building for the last 15 years are aimed at looking for essentially life in extreme environments or life in places where it is very difficult to do the standard microbiological or biological testing. And so we have been building instruments that allow us to measure very, very small amounts of microbial contamination on surfaces, whether it's food preparation surfaces, the hospital operating theater, the hospital operating utensils, and air and water fluids.
Powers' instrument to test water quality instantly using light can be used to monitor a city water supply or a well in an African village. She also designs and builds instruments for the Department of Defense and NASA. Much of that work is secret. But one of her instruments, for example, can detect possible bioterrorism. Another, life on Mars. Since middle school, Powers has been interested in light, or fluorescence. She was a pioneer in the use of something called synchrotron radiation, as well as X-ray absorption spectroscopy. But most of her childhood was spent in a little white house on a modest street in Beckley, West Virginia.
Beckley was a very small town when I was growing up. I knew most of my graduating class. I lived there from the time I was 3. Until I left for college at Virginia Tech when I was 17. My father worked for Eastern Associated Coal Corp, and my mother was a stay-at-home mother.
When did you first realize that you were interested in science? Take me back to that day.
That was third grade, and I wanted a telescope for Christmas, and I got a telescope for Christmas, and I was hooked.
Then I got interested in chemistry because the things in space were made up of different kinds of materials, and I thought that was interesting. And then I got interested in light, and I got interested in explosives, and I got interested in rockets.
Where did that come from? Where did that interest come from?
I have no idea, but it was there, and it was a very strong force in my life.
When she was in the eighth grade at Beckley Junior High, she won first place at the West Virginia State Science Fair for a project using light. It was one of many science fair awards.
My mom in particular didn't understand half of the things that got me excited, but she would sit by the hour and listen to me rant and rave about it.
So you were what we would now call a science geek?
No, yes, very much. I came home one day from high school, and I says, I want to go to college. And, you know, my father's eyes got huge, but nobody said no.
Up to then, no one in the Powers family had gone to college. To see if she was really interested, her parents suggested she take some courses at Marshall University the summer before her senior year of high school.
I took courses in chemistry, and I did some experiments that turned out far beyond what anybody could have anticipated, and I wrote it all up. And that was what I wrote to the Westinghouse Science Talent Search, which I won in my senior year in high school.
Linda Powers was among the top five science students in the nation. It won her a major academic scholarship. She got a PhD in biophysics from Harvard University. From there, she was recruited to lead her own research group at AT&T Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, at the time, the finest research laboratory in the world. All through high school, college, and at Bell Labs, Linda Powers had a series of teachers and mentors who encouraged her to reach for the sky.
What would you tell, if you could, youngsters growing up in West Virginia today? Perhaps math or science geeks like you once were?
The sky's the limit. And in West Virginia, that sky's even closer. There's no reason for you to have any problem doing what you want to do. If you want it, do it. Somebody will take notice along the way and help you. They certainly did me, and this was back when girls didn't do things like that. Don't let anybody stand in your way. Decide what you want and simply go for it. You'll be surprised at the people you'll find who will support you, especially in West Virginia.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
Tune in for the full feature on Linda Powers and others profiled on Inspiring West Virginians tonight at 9 right here on West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can listen to and read news stories on our website, wvpubcast.org. You can subscribe to the podcast of this program while you're there. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpubcast.org. Follow us on Twitter @WVPubNews and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director this morning is Bill Lynch. I'm Beth Voorhees.